The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. For those of you who I've not met, my name is Andrea. And as Jim said, I'm leading this week-long retreat, a daily life practice retreat here, which began yesterday. And the day-long on Saturday is, as he said, it's the ending of that retreat, and I'll be teaching that a day-long in a style that I learned from a teacher in Burma, Sayadaw Utejaniya. And it's a style of meditation practice that works equally well on and off the cushion, which is why I'm finishing my week-long daily life practice retreat with that. But everyone is welcome to attend that day-long, so join us if you are interested. The Buddha often used analogies in his teaching, and one of the analogies he used was to illustrate whether the mind is clear or agitated or disturbed, was the analogy of a pond. If the pond is clear, and you can see through the pond all the way to the bottom and see all the fish and the rocks and the shells on the bottom of the pond, he compared that to a mind that is very clear. Essentially, you can see things as they are in the pond, and a mind that is clear can see things as they are. In contrast, he compared our normal mind, the mind of us, to a muddy pond, a pond that has a lot of sediment that has been stirred up. And so you can't see much in the pond. So to alter that analogy a little bit, but to use it, I like to compare our minds in a way to a jar of muddy water. If we go to that muddy pond with a lot of sediment in it and scoop up a jar of water, and we keep shaking that jar up, it's going to stay cloudy. It's not going to be clear. And that's the way our minds typically are. The agitation of our minds, the disturbances of our mind tend to keep us stirred up. And that stirred up quality of the agitation tends to cloud our minds so that we can't see things very clearly. Instead, we're reactive. We're reacting to things in the world kind of out of that agitation. So in the practice, in the mindfulness practice, the movement is to settle our minds down, to allow that agitation to settle, much as we allow the muddy water to settle, so that we can see through it, so that we can see clearly. So I'd like to talk tonight about settling our minds. There's a couple of different approaches to settling the mind, one being the practice of concentration. The way we settle our minds down with concentration is to keep our attention on one experience, often the breath. The breath is often used as an object for concentration. And we keep coming back to the breath over and over again. And this has this settles our mind because we're not paying attention to those things that keep it stirred up. So essentially we settle our minds by not engaging in the activities that usually keep us stirred up. We let go of the thoughts, the concerns, the worries, the tendencies of our mind that agitate us, and just keep coming back to the breath. Every time we notice our mind is pulled away, we just keep coming back over and over again. So that's one way we settle our minds, and that's that it takes a lot of energy to do this at times, especially if the agitating forces at work in our minds are very strong. But it can be very effective. It does require being in sitting meditation or in some form of formal meditation, though. So this form of concentration to settle our minds isn't so effective in the midst of our day when we're at meetings or dealing with partners. If you're in the midst of a conversation at work, you may or may not be able to say, wait a minute, let me stop and pay attention to my breathing for a little while. So that form of settling the mind has its limitations in terms of our life in the world. So another way to settle our minds is essentially through non-resistance to what is happening in our minds. Essentially, we experience what's going on for us. We experience that agitation without additionally reacting to it and without engaging with it. So if we, think about this jar of muddy water, this analogy of the jar of muddy water again, we could kind of think about the concentration practice as being allowing or helping that jar of water to settle by putting it into a centrifuge machine. There's some activity there that separates the particles from the water. So that's kind of how concentration works. We do something very consciously to separate ourselves from the agitation. This other practice of non-reactivity, of non-resistance, of just essentially allowing and being with, is more like taking that jar of muddy water and putting it on the shelf and just allowing it to settle of its own accord. It will settle as long as we don't keep picking it up and saying, is it settled? Is it settled? So that's another way to practice with this, that it's slower. It's a slower way of settling the mind. It can be a slower way of settling the mind. But it's more organic in a way. It's not forced. And one of the things that we do, essentially what we're doing here, is going back to the muddy water analogy, we're paying attention to the mud. We're paying attention to the cloudiness. We're learning something about the cloudiness as it settles. So we learn something about our minds. We learn something about how our minds engage in these patterns of reactivity, patterns of agitation. What causes our minds to do this? What allows our minds to let go of it? So we learn something about our minds by simply turning towards this experience of agitation, of what is in the water, whether it's desire or aversion or frustration or annoyance or sleepiness or restlessness or doubt. We turn towards it and essentially watch it. And that watching it, bringing mindfulness to it, allows it to settle. So this style of engagement with these difficulties is something that we can do in our daily lives. So I want to talk just a little bit about what it means to do this kind of practice and how to begin. So the things that agitate us, the things that stir us up, that create this feeling of unsettledness, are the very things that tend to create our struggles, our suffering, our difficulty. This agitation itself is often, the sense of that agitation itself is an unpleasant experience where it feels like something is wrong, something is off. And so if we turn towards what the Buddha suggested we do with our struggles, our dissatisfaction, our stress, our suffering, he suggested that we understand it. And so this is what I'm suggesting by, you know, setting the jar on the shelf, that what we're doing is we're turning to understand our suffering. We do this by not engaging in an intellectual way, but more an experiential way. A large part of the stirring process has to do with our thoughts around what's happening to us. We stir ourselves up over and over again by thinking about things, unskillfully thinking about things. You know, how come it's this way? Or why does it have to be like this? And he shouldn't have done that, and she shouldn't do that, and I have to do this. And we stir ourselves up that way. So the instruction in our practice is turning towards our experience, seeing if you can let go of that stirring and just meet what is actually happening in the moment. So this is a lot of our practice, learning to meet ourselves moment by moment. So this might seem like an odd thing, you know, why do we want to meet our suffering? Why do we want to turn towards our suffering? What seems to happen as we do this with mindfulness, if bringing mindfulness to our struggles, to our difficulties, we begin to understand how it comes to be, how it happens for us, how these patterns manifest. And in that understanding of how these patterns happen for us, how we all have our favorite patterns. We all have our favorite flavors of agitation. And as we begin to understand them, we begin to see that it's not so much what's out in the world that we're responding and reacting to. There's some of that. There's some of what's out in the world that we're responding and reacting to. But what we're actually responding and reacting to is something in our minds. It's an idea. It's a belief. It's a view. He shouldn't have done that. She shouldn't have done that. Somebody does something. And then there's the belief. He shouldn't have done that. She shouldn't have done that. I should have done that. It's that belief, it's that idea that we're reacting to. And if you actually look at your minds, if you actually look at what's happening for you, you will see that our reactivity happens not based just on what's happening in the world, but on something that's happening inside our own minds. And as we see this, as we can see this really clearly, the mind starts to let go of those things that it's doing that are contributing to our own struggles, our own dissatisfaction. So this is allowing the settling. This is that process of letting go of the stirring thoughts and turning towards our experience, bringing non-resistance, non-reactivity to our experience. This practice needs patience. It doesn't happen quickly. I mean, you set that jar of muddy water on the shelf and some of it settles kind of fast. The heavier particles settle fast, but some of the lighter particles take a long time to settle. So, you know, it can take a while for this settling to happen by just bringing this non-resistance and non-reactivity to our experience. But this patience is supported by an understanding that the mind will settle as long as we don't keep stirring it up. There's a neurobiologist, Jill Bolte Taylor, who wrote a book called My Stroke of Insight. So it's a great book. If any of you have not read it, I highly recommend it. She had a stroke, and she's a neuroanatomist. She knew something about what was going on in her mind while it was happening. And in her recovery, also, she understood something about what was going on in her mind. And one of the things that happened to her as she was recovering, she began to see some of her old habits and patterns, unwelcome habits and patterns, returning to her mind. She had kind of been free of a lot of difficulty and struggles in her mind because a large part of her brain had been kind of knocked out of gear. And that part of her brain was one of the main portions that engages us in struggle. And so she, as that part started to heal, she began to see these struggles coming back again. But she knew something about the mind, about the brain. And she said, okay, you know, when some kind of reaction happens in the mind, as long as I can just allow it and I don't get engaged with it, I just watch it, I know that it will pass in 90 seconds. That's about how long it takes. You get a hit of hormones that flush through your system when you have some kind of a reaction. It takes about 90 seconds for that wave to pass through. So if you can watch without pushing the button again to release more hormones, that's the stirring, it will settle. So some patience with this can help. So there's five states of mind that in particular tend to stir us up. These states are typically called the hindrances. They are sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, and doubt. So I'd like to talk about these from this perspective of settling, from this perspective of how do we meet these, not through like just trying to ignore them by just coming back to the breath, but how do we actually meet them? How do we turn to them? It's very helpful for learning something about how to meet these, to begin to work with these in our daily lives. So the Buddha, in talking about these hindrances, one of the analogies he used was that he used the analogy of feeding and starving the hindrances. And he said, we need to look at what we're nourishing in our minds. This is kind of that, the shaking of the jar, the spinning thoughts that keep our mind agitated. Those thoughts are feeding these states of mind, feeding these difficult states of mind. When we can let go of those thoughts and just settle with the mindfulness, instead of feeding the hindrances, instead we're feeding the states of peace, of patience, of mindfulness, so that we're nourishing some more wholesome qualities by turning and observing these states instead of continuing to feed them with a pattern, our habitual pattern of engagement with them, acting out on them or continuing to think thoughts about them. So this is the basic thrust here, that we look that with the turning towards, with mindfulness, we essentially are refraining from feeding those hindrances anymore. So I'll talk about each one briefly. So the first, sense desire. This is essentially the desire to have pleasant things in our environment, to have pleasant sense experience at the five sense doors, pleasant sights, pleasant sounds, pleasant taste, pleasant touch, pleasant smells. So the sense desire is not a simple just liking necessarily. It's more of a kind of a feeling of need, that I need to have pleasant things in order to be happy. It's like we are putting our refuge in pleasant things and saying, that's what I'm going to hang my hat on. That's what I'm going to spend my life doing. I'm going to construct my life so that I'm surrounded by pleasantness. And that's what I need in order to be happy. So the sense desire has that kind of needy quality to it, that we feel like we need these pleasant things in order to be happy. It's not the pleasant things themselves that are a problem. It's that neediness, that sense of drivenness, that feeling that we can't be happy unless we construct our lives to surround ourselves with sense pleasure, unless we get what we want. For each of these hindrances, the Buddha had another water analogy that I'll offer. For sense desire, he compared, in all of these, he's looking at it as if it's a bowl of water in which we're trying to see our reflection. And with the sense desire, he compares it to putting dye into the water, that the swirls of dye kind of distract us so that we're more interested in the color than we are in seeing our reflection. So that the dye kind of enchants us with the brilliance of the colors. This is what sense desire does for us. It kind of enchants us into believing that we'll be happy if we get what we want. This sense desire also agitates us. It has that agitating quality because it essentially is pulling us out of what's happening here and now so that we can do something, construct something, get something, organize something, to have something sometime in the future. So we are foregoing a kind of a peace or settledness here and now in favor of hoping that we'll get something pleasant in the future. This is not a terribly good strategy. Partly because, you know, partly we're agitating ourselves here and now. The wanting itself is an agitation. If you actually look at turn towards the feeling of the wanting itself, you'll notice that it doesn't feel very good. We are enchanted by the thing that we want, and so we don't typically notice that it doesn't feel very good to want something. So that's part of what is not so helpful about sense desire, that we're agitating ourselves now. The other thing is that even if we manage to get what we want, even if we manage to control the environment and get these things, then it will not last very long once we get it. Everything that we have the capacity to get in that way is impermanent. And it will fade. It will not last. And so it's not the happiness that comes from getting what we want is a transient kind of happiness. There is a happiness to that. I'll not deny you that. There is a happiness to getting what we want. Some of that comes from the having the moment of pleasure of getting that thing. But actually, more, at least in my experience, what I've seen, more of that pleasure comes from the fact that the wanting goes away. And if you can spend some time actually turning to the wanting, look at the wanting itself, and watch the settling around the wanting, you might get to see it go away. And then you'll see that it feels like being released from a vice grip. So that's our practice with desire, turning the attention towards the feeling of the desire itself. Take our attention out of the thing that we want. Can we let go of the enchantment with the pleasant experience? Turn towards the feeling of wanting itself. So with this practice of non-resistance to sense desire, we need to take care that there's a distinction between turning towards meeting the feeling of the wanting and indulging the feeling of the wanting. So it can take some discernment to notice the difference between that sense of paying attention to the wanting you might think would mean thinking about the thing that you want. That's not what we're talking about here. It's turning towards the actual feeling. The feeling of the pull to satisfy that desire. So sometimes we may find, and with all of the hindrances with this kind of practice, this allowing, this non-resistance, this turning towards, we need to also get familiar with when, if we're trying to be mindful of something, when that pattern, that hindrance, is kind of stronger than our ability to be mindful. Sometimes we can get overwhelmed. It's like our sense desire is like, you know, a big wave, and our mindfulness is a little wave. And it's just the big wave of the sense desire just swamps our capacity for mindfulness, depending on the strength of the desire or the ill will or whatever we are attending to. So we need to learn also some discernment about, in this trying to allow the settling, to be honest about whether it's possible for us to meet this challenge. Is it possible for us to face this hindrance and to actually be mindful of it? If we see ourselves, as we turn with mindfulness to these hindrances, is if we see ourselves kind of getting swamped and just pulled back in to the hindrance, to this, in this case, the sense desire, you know, we might find we just keep getting lost in the fantasy of the having of that thing over and over again, the pleasant fantasy of what our life's going to be like when we get that thing. If you find that in bringing the mindfulness to the sense desire, that's what happens to you, then probably it's not so helpful to try to do this particular practice of meeting the sense desire. Instead, it's more helpful to practice a kind of a skillful ignoring. Put aside the sense desire. Turn your attention to something else that you can pay attention to. It's kind of like a not now approach. It's an ignoring of the that wave, but without aversion. Maybe turn your attention to your feet on the floor, or in daily life you may want to go take a walk. Find a way to distract yourself from the desire. Separate yourself from the thing, and put yourself in another environment where you can see if you can let go of the desire in another way. So putting your attention elsewhere. And that will recur, that kind of pattern will recur with all of the hindrances in a way. So the second is ill will. This is where we have a dislike of things. Dislike of things, people, situations, ourselves, our experience. And this dislike can range from hatred to mild dislike. You know, it can be all along the range. And again, it's not so much that there's a problem having things around us that we dislike, although we think that that's a problem. The problem is, again, that we think that our happiness depends upon either getting rid of those things, changing the situation so that it's not what we don't like, or getting ourselves out of the situation, kind of the fear response of ill will. So again, this is an agitation that of our mind that is basically saying what is here now is not acceptable, and I need to do something, I need to change it. So this wanting, again, it's the wanting to get rid of, this wanting to get rid of is a continued shaking of that jar. You know, there's a situation, and then there's the situation itself has some unpleasantness to it. And then there's this feeling of, I got to get rid of this. And that is actually adding to the agitation. The Buddha's analogy, the Buddha's water analogy for this one is that it's as if the bowl of water that we're trying to look at ourselves in is boiling. So that it's so agitated that we can't see our reflection in the water. So again, the main teaching here, very similar to sense desire, turn away from the thing in the environment that you are averse to and turn toward the feeling of ill will itself. What does it feel like to have this feeling of dislike or hatred or anger or frustration, however this ill will is manifesting? See if you can refrain from acting on it. That just keeps stirring it up. One of the most helpful practices I found in this realm of agitation, particularly in daily life, this kind of ill will. You know, impatience for me is a form of ill will. Often it's like I'm impatient to get something over with. This is not pleasant. I don't like doing this. So for me, that's a lot of how impatience manifests as a form of ill will. Impatience can also manifest from sense desire, that we can't wait for something that we want. But for me, it's often in this form of ill will. And so this afternoon, I was washing my dishes, and I was noticing that as I was washing them, I was just, there was some impatience in my mind. And with that impatience, I also saw that there was a kind of a slightly agitated movement of my body as I was washing these dishes. And in noticing that agitated movement, I recalled one of the practices that I do around this, and that is to see if I could not allow that impatience or that ill will to leak out of my body. So not to try to stop the mind's response, to not try to stop the mental agitation in the mind, to clearly acknowledge this impatience is happening, but to see if I could behave in a way that didn't show it. It's really quite amazing how quickly the mind settles when we turn towards a kind of a settling of the body. And so we're essentially not allowing our body to act on that feeling. So what was happening for me when I was having the agitated movement was that I was acting out of the impatience and unconsciously, in a way, stirring up the impatience. It's like, oh, if I only get this done quickly, it'll be better. When I slowed down my movements, that was not feeding the impatience, and the impatience actually quickly settled. So this is a very helpful practice for us in our daily lives. So again, turning towards the felt experience in the body, seeing if you cannot act on it. See if you can let go of the thoughts around it. And again, recognizing if there's overwhelm, if you find that when you try to attend to some kind of ill will and it swamps your ability to be mindful, don't try to be mindful of that thing. Turn towards something else. Turn towards something else in your experience. Kind of put it aside. It's kind of, for me, I kind of had a little conversation with my ill will when I found that it was too strong. I would say to it, you know, yeah, I see that you're asking for attention. You know, all of these hindrances are kind of asking for our attention. They're trying to get our attention. They're kind of telling us something's wrong here. But we don't respond to them terribly skillfully. You know, we typically respond to them by thinking about these things and continuing to re-agitate ourselves. So in some ways, these hindrances are asking for our attention. And so I acknowledge that. I see that you're asking for attention. But I also see that this isn't a good time to be paying attention to you. So I'm going to just let you do your thing, and I'm going to pay attention to my feet on the ground. And so it was kind of a very light, non-aversive approach to putting it aside. And that whole dialogue with my ill will got collapsed into, not now, not now. I'm just going to pay attention to something else. So it's not a repression. It's not trying to stop that pattern from happening. It's just not giving it any attention. Then there's sloth and torpor. This is a low energy, a sleepiness, a thick mind, a heavy mind, a dull mind. So often this is the mind does not feel clear because there's like fogginess, heaviness in the mind. So the Buddha used an analogy for this one, that the mind is like that bowl of water where it's covered with algae. It's thick with algae. So non-resistance, I mean, typically we resist this particular hindrance, especially if we're trying to be mindful. We have the thought, I can't be mindful when my mind is like this. That's what we believe, that because we're we have this foggy mind that there's no way to be mindful. But we can actually be mindful of anything, including fogginess, dullness of mind. And what I'd like to propose is that when your mind is foggy and dull, one of the easiest things to pay attention to is that fogginess and dullness. That's kind of like, you know, if you're looking out a window on a foggy day, and we had some fog this morning, so you can remember this. So you're looking out the window on a foggy day, and if you're trying to see something in the distance, it's not going to be very easy because the fog is obscuring it. But you can see the fog clearly. So this is a kind of approach to this non-resistance to sloth and torpor. We turn towards the feeling of the dullness, the fogginess, and we actually see that we can clearly know and see dullness of mind. It takes a little shift of perspective to recognize, oh yeah, actually, I can be perfectly clear of dullness. I've seen sometimes this dullness of mind kind of manifest at certain times of the day when I'm tired or, you know, exhausted or I've had a long day or something. And if I'm sitting down for a meal, I'll kind of notice my mind go into this spaced out place. And when I just allow that, rather than fighting that and trying to come back and say, what am I paying attention to? You know, I'm eating here. I really should be paying attention to the meal. You know, rather than having some agenda about what I should be paying attention to, I notice, oh, that checked out space. We can be mindful of spacing out. It's actually possible to be mindful of spacing out. So when I do that, when I kind of allow the mind to go to that checked out space, kind of like gives me the sense of, oh yeah, the mind needs a rest right now. That's what it's doing. It's taking its rest. The mind is taking its rest. And after a few moments of being in that space, it's almost as if the fog clears. And then the mind is back in a place of a little more clarity. So again, this is a possibility for us. Sometimes we don't even consider the possibility that we could pay attention to dullness. Then restlessness and anxiety. There's different kinds of this. There's restlessness of body, physical agitation, feels like jumping beans under your skin. You know, if you have restless leg syndrome, you know what I mean. Then there's a restlessness of mind, where the mind is jumping all over the place, not able to settle on anything. The Buddha uses the bowl of water analogy as if the water is rippled by the wind. The surface of the water is rippled by the wind so that we cannot see our reflection. For physical restlessness, this allowing, actually I think for both physical and mental restlessness, the allowing, one of the easiest things to do in allowing this, again, we can allow the experience, but it sometimes feels like there's so much energy in our mind and body that some of our habit around focusing is kind of like a narrowing of our attention. So when we try to bring our mindfulness to restlessness, if we do it in our habitual way of like, okay, what is this restlessness? How do I pay attention to this restlessness? It's like putting ourselves in a pressure cooker because there's so much energy. And so a different approach is to kind of like allow the restlessness to get as big as it wants. Let it fill the whole room and allow your awareness to fill the whole room. It really allows quite a settling, but it allows quite a bit of relaxation to happen if we don't kind of force ourselves down with this restless energy. With the restless mind, there's often a emotion underneath, something that's churning or spinning us. Something that we're perhaps worried about or fretful about. And so sometimes we can touch into an emotion underneath. You know, it might be sadness, or it might be a feeling of loss. You know, there's all kinds of things that can be underneath that we can be agitated about that keep our mind stirred up and restless. So if you can kind of check in when the mind is restless, especially spinning with thought, check in and see if there's an emotion that is producing all of those thoughts. And see if you can ground your attention in that emotion. And then there's doubt. Doubt is primarily in this respect about the teachings and our belief, our view of whether the teachings are valuable, and whether we have the capacity to engage with those teachings. So we may have doubts in ourselves, in our ability to practice. We may have doubts in the teachings. We may have doubts in the teacher. Often this manifests as a kind of a vacillation, a wavering of not able to make a decision. Oh, should I do this? Oh, no, I shouldn't do that. Maybe I should do this. Oh, no, maybe I should. Oh, I can't do that. Maybe I should try that. So we end up vacillating. So there's not a sense of stability. The mind can't decide what to do, or it's full of all kinds of logical arguments about why we can't do this. The analogy for this is the water clouded by mud. So we're back to our muddy water analogy. The main thing that we need to do with doubt is to learn to recognize the story of doubt, the narrative of doubt. He says primarily doubt manifests as thought. It's often, if you find yourself thinking about the practice, about the teachings, about the teachers, about what kind of practice you should do, that is probably an indication doubt is present. Even if it sounds like a very wise thought, it's probably doubt. So again, turning towards, see if you can let go of the thought and see if there's some underlying feeling. Often there's an underlying sense of perhaps a fear of vulnerability, a feeling of vulnerability, a feeling of inadequacy, a fear of failure. There's something underneath. So see if you can connect with the feeling that's under the doubt, the feeling that's connected with the doubt. And be open to what you might find. There's so many things. At one point I found grief under doubt. So, you know, to not necessarily have an idea or a view about what you might find, but be open. Let go of the thoughts and say, what's here? What else is here? So I need to stop, but I want to say one last thing, and that is that we often have this sense, the feeling that the hindrances are in the way of our practice. You know, this is, they're called the hindrances after all, right? I mean, they're hindering us. But what I'd like to say or propose is that this turning towards these states, this meeting without resistance, it puts us in a completely different relationship with these hindrances. And when we are able to meet them with mindfulness, they no longer function as hindrances. They actually serve as our path. They serve as the compost out of which our transformation happens. In my practice, many of my insights have been related to, many of my openings and clear understandings have been related to watching the hindrances, right in the midst of the hindrances, seeing something, an insight arises, a clear seeing of how I'm holding on to something, and it falls apart. Many of these have happened in my daily life. So this practice of turning towards the hindrances isn't something that we do just to get past them, so that we can then get on to the real practice. When they're present, they are the practice. And they open us to freedom. So I need to stop. So thank you for your attention. My apologies for going 2 minutes over.